everyone, and welcome to the Image Doctors, March 15th, 2007. I think we're up to episode number 36. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker, and beware the Ides of March.
Beware,
right?
Indeed.
Yeah, I guess...
It's a great day for... it's not a good day to be a Roman emperor.
Or hang around senators, something like that.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So, that's our... we should have a toga party.
There you go.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, we got a... well, what we think should be a fun show on time for you. I don't know.
We'll leave that up to you.
We'll let the listeners decide.
Now, I guess one of the things that we'll be talking about is PMA.
Mm-hmm.
And you made a little trip out there on your own.
I made a last-minute decision to go it alone and show up at PMA. So I will give my PMA show report. I didn't get to everything, but I got to enough of the good stuff, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We've got some... we had a suggestion from a listener to talk more about historical Nikon products. So today we've brought in the FM2N and FE2, and we'll talk about those.
Yeah, and we'll kind of talk about the whole FM FE series a little bit.
So that'll be on our list.
Fun topic.
This will be a recurring theme. We hope mm-hmm. to do from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we'll have our weekly prescription from the Image Doctors.
Right, and this one will be on Phil Flash.
Yep. Well, let's start with my trip to Las Vegas.
Right.
And there was a great t-shirt in one of the booths there, and it said, "What happens in Vegas gets photoshopped out." I thought that was pretty entertaining. And for our international listeners who are not familiar with why that's funny, the Las Vegas Tourism Board has some commercials here in the United States that around the theme of what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Because mm-hmm. maybe you stayed out too late or something like that.
Or something like that.
Yeah. As everybody probably was aware, the PMA show was held last week from Thursday through Sunday, and a bunch of new products came out, but nothing really earth-shattering mm-hmm. from a Nikon perspective. Nothing to worry about, really, but right. some nice products nonetheless. So I went to the Nikon booth, my first stop. I walked right past those other guys' big booth, that red one, and I just kept walking
as
if it wasn't even there.
Yeah.
And I didn't get sucked
just
in.
Just avert your eyes.
It didn't hurt.
Avert your eyes.
It didn't hurt. You know, I just walked right past and no one did anything. I was wearing my D2X cap, darn it.
Mm-hmm.
That was important.
Yeah. That's why they ignored you, probably.
Good bet.
Yeah.
But the two new products that Nikon rolled out at this year's PMA show that weren't Coolpix cameras, because they came out with their annual or semi-annual refresh of the Coolpix line,
mm-hmm.
Was the D40X and a new 55-200 AFSG VR kit lens.
Yep. No D3 yet, but perhaps later.
Let's just say that when I talked to the guys at the Nikon booth, they assured me that you pro Nikon shooters will be taken care of later this year.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, so don't even ask. I don't know what it is.
Don't ask, don't tell.
But I'm not under any NDA, so I don't have any information.
So
anyway,
next topic.
But the D40X came out, which is a modest update to the D40, mm-hmm. which was announced back in December. And really all this was the addition of the 10.2 megapixel sensor.
Right.
It costs a little bit more, a couple $100 more.
And that's a very nice resolution.
It is.
It really is.
Now,
same
I don't
as
know
the
anything.
D200, D80, and that's very nice.
And it makes sense from a manufacturing standpoint. You're going to try to reuse as many of the same components across mm-hmm. your line as possible.
Mm-hmm. Now, we haven't talked a lot about the D40.
No, that's true, because neither of us have had one.
No, but maybe let's just spend a minute on that. You know, who might this be for, in your opinion? You've had a chance to handle it.
I took a test shot with the D40. I'll tell you, it takes nice... from just looking at the LCD panel, it takes a nice picture. Even with the kit lens, it took a nice shot. I used the pop-up flash at the Nikon booth, and the little test image I took had lots of pop to it. It looked really nice. The D40 proper, which is the 6-megapixel camera, it uses the same sensor, or a modified version of the sensor that used to be in the D50, the D70, that mm-hmm. that line. I think it costs about $550 mm-hmm. roughly, and it comes with an 18-55 kit lens.
Yeah. So pretty inexpensive.
I mean, if you're looking to get into digital photography, what this camera is intended to be for is the person who takes, who wants to step up and take better pictures of their family, of their kids. You know, you go to your kid's Little League game, and you want to take pictures where you're not waiting for the shutter.
Right.
You know, and you get a much better quality. It does very good high ISO.
So it's a step up from a point and shoot.
It really is. I mean, the Nikon discontinued their Coolpix 8800 series, the 8800s and the 8700s, that line, which was their advanced point and shoot cameras. Whether or not they come back out with something that replaces those, I don't know. But in the meantime, you can think of, if you were potentially in the market for something like a Coolpix 8800, a D40 is all that and nicer.
Yeah. I guess the other way around on it is, let's say you're using something like a D80 and you want a backup camera body, D40 or D40X would be a lower cost option that's very compact, uses the same memory cards, so it's compatible. And it also could be something that your spouse is going to use if they're not quite as into photography, perhaps.
The D40, when I handled it, it really is intended to be used in one of the scene or program modes, or the idiot modes, as we call them. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with that. It's going to take nice pictures.
Yeah.
It has the option to give you the full manual control if you want, but because it's not designed for someone who would be using those features all the time, access of those manual controls are a little bit more buried. Mm-hmm. They're not just out there. You don't have the two command dials. In fact, you don't have an LCD panel on the top of the camera, but it's really small. And if you're looking for something that's lightweight and easy to pack and takes excellent pictures pretty much anywhere you go, nothing wrong with a D40.
Right.
I don't know how the image quality of the D40X will be because it's going to be using a different sensor.
But probably a lot like the D80.
You could expect that.
Yeah.
The one difference with the X as compared to the original is that the X can be purchased as body only. You don't have to buy it with the kit lens, which is how the D40 is set up. So, I mean, I think from the D40, D80, these both use SD memory cards. They're really in line, in place to cover pretty much any kind of casual hobbyist or family snapshot kind of shooter. I would say if you're never going to get past just having a, you know, the, I need to have a camera in my bag to go on vacation with, I need to have a camera to take pictures of the kids, D40 is going to be everything you need. Mm-hmm. If you're the kind of person who's saying, well, I really want to get into photography and I want a starter camera for photography, then you might want to lean towards the D80.
Right.
The D80 will have one advantage over the biggest difference of the D80 over the D40. Well, there's a lot of differences, but the biggest thing in terms of practical, you know, growth into the camera is that the D80 supports all of Nikon's AF lenses and will autofocus with them. The D40 does not have that little screwdriver motor in the camera. It only can drive AFS Nikon lenses.
Right.
Or their third-party equivalents, but right. I don't think there are too many of those. So now, that's what I saw.
Yep. Now, you went by the Hoodman booth, right?
I sure did. I had to visit my friends at Hoodman. Those guys are really nice people.
Mm-hmm. And you got a little gizmo there, too.
I parted with a little bit of cash, and I bought a hood loop. And we talked about the hood loop in our stocking stuffer episode, I think, for Christmas 06.
But neither of us got one in our stocking.
No.
Just a lump of coal or something like that.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Hanukkah Harry didn't come to my house this year for that. But I got one. I plunked down my cold hard cash at the Hoodman booth, and they were willing to sell me one of these nice guys that they are. And it's pretty nice. It is not a magnifier, although you might think it was from looking at it.
It looks a lot like just a normal loop.
Yeah,
if you're looking at film.
It's a rubber sort of pyramidal, what's the word here? It's, you know, it's rectangular, but it's a pyramid shape.
That's a good word, by the way. I was impressed.
Yes, it's got a sort of a tetrahedron kind of configuration to get really technical.
But it feels pretty nice.
And it's solid rubber, and it's got a neck lanyard. So you can wear this loop around
your neck.
It's
real plastic, I think.
It's real plastic?
Yeah, real plastic.
Genuine.
With some rubber.
But then it's got a lens in the top that you look through. So it's not just a, It's not just a piece of rubber to shade your mm-hmm. your LCD, but this is the ultimate chimping accessory.
Right.
It's got a diopter adjustable, focusing adjustable eyepiece on it. You stick it on the back of your camera when you're reviewing an image, and it doesn't magnify the image particularly much. It's not intended to. It just lets you see it very cleanly.
Yeah, and in bright light, that helps a lot if you're shading out all that light.
And since you can just wear this around your neck, it's not going to really get in the way.
Yeah, and I tried one of the covers that flips up, and I didn't really care for that. It seemed like a good idea, but what I found is it was always closed at the wrong time, and you know, all of those kind of things. So it was a little bit of a hassle. This seems like it would work better.
It's definitely a nice little accessory.
Yeah.
Now, they list for $70 US, so it's not a cheap little accessory. But I think for outdoor photographers who do a lot of, you know, you want to check to make sure your image is in focus and you're using your LCD screen a lot in bright conditions, which a lot of us do, this is truly the way to achieve that kind of satisfaction.
Yeah, I can see it being handy.
Well, where else did I go?
Oh, I think you saw Sigzilla.
I did. I had to stop by the Sigma booth, which actually, I'll admit, was the first place that I stopped.
Right.
As I was walking through and I passed the other guys, I saw Sigma and I said, I'm going to walk over there and say hello to my friend, the Sigma rep. And so I said, hi, Tom, how are you doing? Do you have the thing? Oh, yes, you do. And there on the booth, I don't know if Sigma had any other product at the show because I wasn't looking at them. Which isn't fair because they announced some other lenses and some other products at the show. But there on the booth in a foam cradle was the prototype flown in from Japan of their new 200 to 500 f2.8 behemoth.
A manly lens, if there ever was one, I would say.
What more can... Words failed me when I saw it. So I said to Tom, the Sigma rep, I said, Tom, how much does this sucker weigh? Because everybody knows that no one knows how much it costs.
Right.
That wasn't the fair question. No price has been set for this monstrosity of an optic.
Yeah.
It weighs 28 pounds.
Ugh.
So you're talking over, like, what, 11, 12, 13 kilos?
Oh, a lot.
That's a lot of mass. Now, the hood weighs another 7 pounds. Because it was a prototype, though, they haven't fully decided what they're going to do. I suggested carbon fiber construction, and they told me, yeah, we're thinking about doing that.
So the hood alone weighs as much as most super telephotos.
Yeah, I think the 200 to 400 we use doesn't weigh much more than 7 or 8 pounds.
That's about what it weighs. That's amazing.
At this time. Mm-hmm. At the current time. Now, there's an integrated tripod mount on the bottom of this thing.
I hope so.
I asked if it was HSM, and they said, no, it's not HSM. And I know a lot of people were like, why not? Well, apparently the HSM motor wouldn't be strong enough to drive the darn thing. So it gets some kind of power from the camera. They had a Sigma...
Like a Chevy V8 powered maybe instead?
Mopar.
Yeah, I Mopar.
Think. I'm
Hemi?
Not sure. Yeah. It's got a Hemi.
Yeah.
That could be a great slogan for that Sigma lens. Has that got a Hemi? Sorry, another U.S. commercial parody.
Yeah.
Anyhow, the zoom on the sucker is motorized. So when you turn the zoom, the zoom was disabled on the prototype, but I could focus with it. I could look through it, and it really does work. And it's got an LCD screen on the back of the lens that tells you what the focal length is and what the focus distance is, because, you know, it would be utterly impractical to look at the top to try to find, you know, what you might be set at. Who is going to buy this?
I think you
rich
hit
people or I don't know. I mean, I was trying to think of the practical application for this lens, and I'm not it.
Well, you know, maybe something for pool photographers, something like that.
Stationary, where you're sort
Sports
of set up
Illustrated.
In a station. I could see that if you're at the NASCAR race and you're at the top of the grandstand and you're shooting it, or something, security surveillance type of application. Who knows? But this thing looked like a beast.
Something tells me we're never going to own one.
I'm guessing this is going to be a five-figure lens easily.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Expected availability end of this year.
Yep.
Now, I should mention they also had an 18 to 200 OS, which is their version of VR.
Mm-hmm. It's nice to see them doing more with image stabilization.
Yeah, and Tamron actually introduced some image stabilized lenses of their own, which was something that we thought might be coming down the road after going to last year's PMA, I didn't visit Tamron this time.
Right.
Now, before I get too carried away, I should point out that I've ran into some fellow Nikonians at the PMA show, and I wanted to give them a nice little shout out. Mm-hmm. So say hello to Arata Ogura, and who came all the way out from Japan. Mm-hmm. And so I saw Arata by the Hoodman booth, and we exchanged hellos, and it was nice to see you there. So I'm glad that we were able to meet. And also at the Nikon booth, I ran into Leonard Rawl, who came out from Florida for mm-hmm. PMA, and he had his Nikonian's neck strap on.
Ooh.
He was representing. It was excellent.
The world's finest.
It was truly, yeah. Well, after our last episode where we talked about the darn things.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Couple quick notes. I did stop in the Sony booth, and I saw that prototype body for their flagship, and I will say the little description underneath it was incredibly vague. It just said, new flagship coming soon with a new sensor.
Yeah.
Don't know what that means. And then, of course, I paid a visit to our friends at the Think Tank Photo.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a new product line they just announced, which is not actually available yet on their website. It's not even on their website. But they had these products at the show, which makes sense because I think PMA is really a show that it's not really intended for consumers to come in and see all the toys, although we do. Mm-hmm. It's more intended for businesses to sell to other businesses. So
right.
If you make a product, this is where you're going to run into the retailers who might want to carry your product.
Right.
So Think Tank had their stuff, and their new line is something called the Urban Disguise, and that was a really nice little holster bag. Actually, not really a holster bag. It almost looks like a messenger bag.
Right.
A small shoulder bag, rectangular, doesn't look at all like a camera bag. It's got that flap. It looks like just kind of a messenger bag, like mm-hmm. you might carry papers in it or something. And they have them in all different sizes, up to briefcase size practically. Mm-hmm. They had one that will hold two pro SLRs with lenses attached side by side. And the whole idea of this Urban Disguise is that you're walking around and you're not saying, hey, I'm a photographer, but you can carry all your stuff in it.
Right.
And traditional, typical Think Tank construction, they look well built.
Yeah.
I didn't get
probably lots of clever features too.
Yep. And then they have these new digital holster bags, which are intended to hold a single SLR with something as large as a 70 to 200 lens attached to it. And they had a neat little feature. In most cases, these holster bags will hold your camera body with the lens with the hood reversed. But these had a zipper on the bottom that kind of like the expandable luggage, where you can unzip it and it expands. Mm-hmm. Well, this thing had an expandable pouch on the bottom where if you unzipped it, the bottom of the holster bag sort of dropped down an extra couple of inches.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could put your 70-200 with lens in position, so the lens on the normal way, mm-hmm. for quick access. So that was a neat little product. You can look for those coming out from Think Tank soon. And if you're interested in buying from Think Tank, you know that if you go to the Nikonians.org homepage and you click the Think Tank link on the homepage, you'll not only get a free gift with your purchase from ordering from Think Tank directly through that link, but also if it's over $50, which believe me is not hard to do with these guys. But also a certain portion of your proceeds go back to help support the site and keep us in business. So that's a good, so that we can come and yap at you for an hour every other week.
Yep.
Now there was tons of other stuff at PMA, but I was only there one day, so I didn't really get to see it. I said hi to some people, but we'll see we'll see what happens out the rest of the year.
Very fine summary of the highlights. That was awfully good.
Of PMA?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Darned impressive there. Okay.
Oh, you know, I aim to please, Rick. I tell you what, you know.
All right. So now,
because I photoshopped out the other stuff.
I did, but I saw one of the pictures. That was pretty good.
Oh, yeah. Hey, there were some models in some booths.
Yeah, there were, apparently.
That was pretty cool.
Okay.
So we wanted to start a quasi-recurring theme of talking about historical gear.
Mm-hmm.
One of our listeners wanted to hear more about that. So this week,
quasi-recurring means if people don't send us hate mail, we'll do it again.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
hate mail didn't overflow too much this week.
No, not too bad.
So we were doing good on that. And you brought in your FM2N mm-hmm. and the FE2. And now these are the updated versions of the original FM series and FMN, or was it just FM?
FM and FE.
FM and FE series.
Right.
Sorry, I get a little lost in my history. I never was good at history.
So let's talk about this.
So what's special about the FM and FE series?
Well, just some interesting history on it. The FM came out in 1977, It was the same time that Nikon moved away from their old meter coupling system where they had the external couplings, you know, little rabbit ears and stuff, and went with the little tabs instead. That's when the AI type lenses came out and AI compatible bodies. And that's when the FM came out. And it was smaller than other Nikon bodies up to that point. One of the things that was going on in the mid-70s is that Olympus had introduced the OM1 and OM2 series, and they were really doing well with those. And those, if you've never handled them or seen them, are remarkably small little SLR cameras. They're really pretty neat. And everyone was kind of heading in that direction. That was the big thing, was make everything as small as possible. It's funny, all the trends that the industry goes through, but both the bodies and the lenses were all downsized over the span of a few years, and all the manufacturers were doing that. And it was funny, if you saw an article in that time, Popular Photography or Modern Photography, you know, one of the first things that had to be mentioned was the dimensions. You know, how wide was it, how tall, and a little comparison photos. So that was the big thing. And the FM was reacting to that. Now, it's not as small as an Olympus. It was a little bit bigger. And frankly, my opinion, a little bit nicer to handle as a result, if you have medium-sized hands or bigger. But the original FM, which is a lot like the later FM2N in many ways, is a manual-only body, no exposure automation at all. It's just a match needle or match LED kind of approach where you look through the viewfinder and you turn your little shutter speed dial on top and the aperture ring.
So the whole built-in meter
thing until it lights up with a little zero in the middle. And it works very, very well. Now, along with the camera, they introduced a new motor drive. It was originally the MD-11 that came out with it, and it was later updated to one that looked a lot like the MD-11, but it's called the MD-12. And that was just for, you know, once they put out some of the later series of cameras, it helped the Meteor system work a little bit better with the motor drive. But about a year or so after the FM came out, they introduced the FE, which was the same thing, but with aperture priority automation introduced, and it worked a lot like the older EL and EL2 series.
And that's the one I'm familiar with because that was my first camera.
Yeah, yeah. And so when we were looking at them earlier and you were looking through the viewfinder, you saw something that looked an awful lot like what you'd see through an EL2. But in addition to a scale on the side with shutter speeds and a meter needle pointing to where the camera thought it should be set, you also saw the aperture through a little window at the top, which is very handy.
And, you know, and you've got something on this camera that I missed.
Haven't seen in a while.
Yeah, you've got the...
The Never Ready?
Yeah, exactly. the leather, you know, body case, but right. The bottom of it attaches to your body.
Right.
Now, it's kind of cool because it gives it a little bit more... It's a little easier on the hand to hold the...
And if you're outside and around rocks and stuff, it's a little bit of protection.
Yeah, and then it would snap on the case that would cover over the lens, right? Usually a short lens.
And I never used those.
But of course, like you say, if you have to go and change film or something, you've got to take the whole thing off. But it's not too bad.
No, it's not too bad. If you're just using the bottom part, which is all I ever use.
I just miss the days of the leather.
Oh, it was so cool.
You get that. You know, it just seemed like when you got the camera, you could get these nice leather accessories and stuff.
Yep. So, like we were talking about, the FE was a lot like the EL or EL2 in terms of how it worked. Now, fast forward a few years, and now it's the early 80s, and they updated the whole series and started off with the FM2, which was a lot like the FE, except that it had a top shutter speed of 4,000th of a second, which was really, really good at that time. Mm-hmm. That was twice as fast as anything else up to that point. And it also had a higher flash sync speed. The original was 125th of a second, and the original FM2 went up to 200th of a second flash sync. And a few little changes inside the viewfinder and stuff like that, but fundamentally the same nice camera. And then not too long after that, they came out with the FE2. And that was, not surprisingly, an updated version of the FE with the same faster shutter in it, up to 4,000th of a second. And few other little changes on it. Nothing super major. The primary things were in the shutter area, and also very, very nice camera. Did a little improvement to the FM2, making it an FM2N, and that's where the flash sync went up to 250th of a second. And with those later cameras, they had interchangeable focusing screens, which you can actually still modify with a very recent screen out of the FM3A. It's called a K3 screen or an E3 screen or a B3 screen, and those are pretty bright. And those will work with those FE2 and FM2N kind of bodies quite well.
Now, I got a question for you. Mm-hmm. So we're in that mid-80s time frame, so let's anchor us on the... You know, I want to see where these fit in the product line. Mm-hmm. And if you were going to buy the top, the F would have been an F2 or an F3?
F3.
At this point, so we're talking F3.
If you're talking about the time period of the FM2N.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, FE2. These cameras we have here in the studio today.
And actually, around that time, I was in college, and I sold cameras in a camera shop to make money. So those are the ones I was selling. So yeah, the F3 was the top of the line.
And where did these fit in? Were these sort of mid-range models?
Mid-range. There was also the FA that was more expensive than these two. It was fairly close in price to an F3. And in addition to the aperture priority automation that you found on the FE2, it also had shutter speed, priority automation, and program mode.
Okay.
And it was also the camera that first came out with, it was called AMP, but it was the early version of matrix metering. And
but these use center-weighted metering like we're used to.
The FE2 and FM2N use center-weighted metering.
No spot metering?
No spot metering.
Okay. So I'm just trying to put us in time for it. Because, you know, it's interesting. These are... What did these go for? What did these sell for? And do you remember?
You know, when I was selling them, I want to say the FM2N was around 2.25, I think, you know, US, and the FE2 was maybe around 300.
Which in 1980, I mean, that's a lot of money still.
Sure.
That was, these
yeah,
were not
I think
cheap.
An F3 was, you know, around 500, perhaps, something like that.
Interesting. It's just interesting to get the ballpark now.
Right.
You think for a $200 camera today, but it's not. These are built
really
absolutely
well.
Solid. They're all metal.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's no plastic on these things other than, you know, whether you would call it a leatherette on the body cladding. But
and let's talk about them from today's perspective. And frankly, you know, the FM2N was made until very recently, not that long ago. And the FE2, in my opinion, ended up turning into the FM3A, very similar camera in a lot of respects. And that was made until just recently. So these were around a long time, which tells you something about how well designed they were from the start and how useful they still are as photographic tools. And there's a reason I still have mine. I still use mine on occasion. I don't use them as much as my D2X, but I still enjoy going out and shooting with them. And one of the reasons is awfully nice ergonomics. I mean, it is just a very nice camera to handle and use. It is very compact, and both of them are very straightforward. You know, what I find is that when I go out and shoot with them, it's very relaxing. You know, there's not a lot to think about. You're not going to chimp, that's for sure. You know, you don't have a whole bunch of modes and things to worry about. If you're really reasonably familiar with photography, they're just easy to use. And if your subject isn't sports photography or wildlife photography, chances are these will work quite well for you. And you can use them for that too. It just, they're a little bit tougher than some of the modern stuff with autofocus and stuff. But for things like landscape and, you know, a lot of other things, they're great. Very simple. Very straightforward. The lenses, too, that most people will use with them are the non-autofocus variety, you know, the AI or the AIS lenses.
But you can still mount the autofocus lenses on
them.
Oh,
sure, you can. Yeah. It's just that you give up some things, I think.
I agree.
The older lenses are just so solid, so smooth to focus, They really complement the camera as well. They look right too. I mean, that's a little thing, but they do look a little bit better. The main thing is that they're just nicer to use in manual focus mode. And there are some really great deals on them. Now, the lenses I've got on these bodies right now on the FM2N that I've got with me, I've got an AIS 20mm 2.8, and that I bought used, both of the lenses I bought used, and I think it cost me $200 tops for that.
I can remember when a 20mm 2.8 even manual focus was a fairly expensive.
Right, but as you can see, it's still in really nice shape.
Mm-hmm. It's excellent.
And I've had it for quite a while. So that was a great deal. On the FE2, I've got an AIS 35mm F2 lens. Guess how much that lens cost me? Just take a guess.
Oh, well, it's in very good shape. I mean, it's got mm-hmm. a few little scratches in the paint, but so what?
Yeah.
The glass is pristine.
Mm-hmm.
35mm, well, those weren't the most expensive, but it's an F2. I don't know, probably cost you, I'll say $125.
I paid $30 for it. So there are some amazing deals out there on the older manual focus lenses if you look around a little bit. And I've had that one for quite a few years now, at least 10 years, and very nice lens.
And a lot of times people are selling these old things on the Nikonians I want to sell for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good place to start if you're looking.
Yep. Yep. Let someone else's mistake be your gain, I guess, in this case, because they really are nice to use. And as we've talked about before, you know, a lot of people are starting in photography for the first time with digital, and digital's fun, and you can do some great things with it, and both of us enjoy it. But I think there is an alternate photographic experience that you might miss just by jumping straight to digital, and that's shooting with film.
It's a parallel reality.
It's a parallel reality. It's a different pleasure. That sounds interesting. And one
what
that
happens at the Image Doctors
stays on the podcast. Yeah. But I recommend it at the prices that are out there right now for really nice manual focus bodies and lenses. You can't beat them, and give it a try. You might find yourself enjoying it in a way that's different than digital.
Very nice.
Very nice.
Thanks for that. And we will always be open to everybody's suggestions for what other gear you might. Because yeah. Lord knows it's sitting in Rick's closet.
I know. I have a ridiculous amount of this stuff because I can't bear to part with it.
But it is really nice.
It is nice stuff.
You can't. I mean, once you've held one of these, they are really solid, good cameras.
Yep.
So we have a little time left this week to talk about our weekly prescription.
Right.
And we found this suggestion for a topic in the podcast feedback forum.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve Birtles from England mm-hmm. had posted in there a question.
Right.
And he wanted to know about fill flash. And I know we've talked about it before, but his question was, when do you use fill flash?
Right.
How do you identify conditions?
Right.
That would be ideal for fill flash.
And he was also having a little bit of a problem with photos being a little bit too bright and washed out. So let's talk a little bit about that.
It's an area for some discussion.
Yep. Yep. So fill flash, when are you going to use it?
Well, as we were discussing before we started the show, the first thing that comes off the top of my head is when you are taking a picture outdoors. Well, first of all, you're going to use it outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually fill flash is done to balance ambient light. And indoors, the ambient light is rarely strong enough to be the primary source of light.
Mm-hmm.
So indoors, you're going to use, if you use flash, it's going to be, the flash will be the primary source of light. So it's not in fill flash mode.
Right. Not usually.
So you're going to go outside. And in the typical situation where I've used fill flash is, you have a picture of, let's say you want to take a picture of your significant other, and it's, you know, the middle of the day, so the light's pretty flat, and maybe you are standing in the shade on the veranda somewhere, and there's this wonderful lush, you know, background, mm-hmm. some scenic background. And you take the picture the normal way with the regular matrix metering, and one of two things happens. You'll either get a wonderful shot of the background mm-hmm. exposed properly.
And a silhouette.
And a silhouette, or you'll have a okay exposure of your significant other with a completely washed out background.
Yep.
There's just too much dynamic range in that image to get it. Mm-hmm. Or you've got harsh shadow. You got shadows on the person's face because, you know, you don't want them staring right in the sun, or maybe they're right. side lit or something.
Right.
So that's a case where to get rid of the harsh shadows or to fill in the light on the subject, you illuminate your close subject with the flash, mm-hmm. but you let the ambient light be the primary basis for the exposure, so the background.
Right. So that's the classic situation. That's where most people use it. There is another situation where it can be useful to do that, and that's just in a situation where you have very flat, dull lighting. You know, think about those photos that come back and everything just looks kind of gray and the colors are kind of muted. A little bit of fill flash can make the colors in the primary subject just pop out.
Exactly.
Yeah. Give it a little bit more punch. And, you know, a long time ago we talked about bird photography, and that's what we were doing with flashes on our cameras for those shots using the better beamer. Mm-hmm. The primary purpose there was to bring out the colors.
Yeah, or to compensate for a side-lit subject. Mm-hmm. You know, that's usually what you have when you've got a subject that's moving around and you can't tell it to say, hey, stop there and be nice front-lit. You need to add a little flash because otherwise the shadows will just look too dark in the image.
Right.
You won't get a good pop to
right.
the image.
Now, to take advantage of the fill flash, you want your flash set to matrix balance fill flash. So just consult your manual on how to do that. It's usually just by hitting the mode button.
And it'll say right something like TTL BL. Mm-hmm. And that BL stands for balanced fill flash.
Right. Now, theoretically, what that's supposed to do is vary the intensity of the flash so that you get a nice, natural-looking portrait under that lighting that we were talking about earlier. Now, what I usually find is it's still a little bit strong for my taste.
Which is probably what Steve was experiencing mm-hmm. with his pictures, is that
that's
was getting
guess.
These kind of overcooked images.
Yeah, and if you're fairly close to your subject and stuff is still coming out overcooked, what you can do is dial back the exposure compensation on a flash a little bit. You know, minus a stop, stop and a third. Stop in two-thirds, you know, play around with it a little bit. It'll depend on how large the subject is in the viewfinder.
And when you say dial down the exposure compensation on the flash, what Rick is he means on the flash itself, you want to dial down go negative on the flash head, not to be confused with exposure compensation on your camera body.
Right.
Because that's a totally different thing. You want to leave that alone. You want to allow the camera to meter normally. And you're just reducing or increasing, in some cases, the amount of fill flash output.
Right. Now, you can also do that on pop-up flashes that are built into cameras. And in that case, the control is on the body, but it's a different one than the exposure compensation. And again, just consult your instruction manual. And it'll show you how to do
that. It'll be something called flash exposure compensation, mm-hmm. usually.
Yeah.
That's where I've seen it listed.
Right. Now, if you're using a digital body, you know, unlike the FM2 and FE2 that we were talking about earlier, it's really easy to check, you know, check the image afterwards. Although the LCD screen isn't, you know, the best way of evaluating images for, you know, color or brightness, you can get a sense of it. And you can tell if the primary subject is much brighter than the background.
Well, it's easy because now that I've got a hood loop,
yeah,
I can just plop that on there when I'm in my bright.
There you go.
Bright situation,
and you'll be set.
Shameless plug.
Yeah.
So, Steve, hopefully that has helped to answer your question, and we appreciate mm-hmm. the feedback.
Yeah. Now, keep in mind, if your subject starts getting farther away and it's really small, it's really easy for it to get overcooked because then the camera and flash are trying to illuminate the background, and that's going to be a lot of flash. So it's one last thing to remember.
So as a general rule, when you're setting your flash, if you're inside, you want it to say TTL. If you're outside, you want it to say TTL BL.
Right.
And that's the first thing that you should check if you want to make sure that your flash is set to the right mode.
Right. For your situation.
For the situation.
That little tip right there cures most problems with Flash.
Well, let's hope so.
Yep.
And we're always looking for your suggestions and your tips that we may use them on the air.
Yep.
And there's two ways to reach us. One is by email.
And that's talkradio@nekonians.org.
And the second way is in the podcast feedback forum, mm-hmm. which is where we pulled Steve's tips out of.
Yep.
So keep them coming.
Yep, we appreciate them.
Now we have a special treat for you this week.
A contest.
And we are going to post a trivia question in the show notes page. And if you've never been to the show notes page, here's a good reason to go there.
Yeah.
We're going to have a question posted in the show notes, which, and you can get to all of our shows, the whole archive, from blog.nikonians.org, and then just click on the Image Doctors podcast link mm-hmm. from that main page. And you'll also find all kinds of other juicy news and tidbits and mm-hmm. other things like that, like the picture of me with Sigzilla.
That's right.
Shame on me for posting that in the forums. Yeah. You never know where it might turn up.
So if they go there, they'll see the question and the instructions for how to post their answer in the podcast forum. And
right. That's what we're going to do. We'll have a link to the podcast forum, and the first person to post the correct answer to our trivia question for this week in the podcast feedback forum mm-hmm. will win a prize.
Yep.
And what are they going to win?
I'm sure it's something very valuable, right?
Oh, I was just looking around here at the Mountain Lair, and I've got some copies of my Capture NX ebook on CD-ROM.
So not quite as valuable as I thought.
Okay.
But not bad.
Tell them what they've won, Bob. This week, you've won an outstanding trip to nowhere.
And an ebook.
Yeah. So what we're going to do is I will ship you one of my ebook CD-ROMs, The Photographer's Guide to Capture NX, and we will contact the winner via a private message in the forum. Mm-hmm. That's the plan.
Yep.
So get out your thinking caps and check out the blogs.
I'm sure it'll be a very challenging question.
That's right.
Yep.
What is Rick's middle name? No, I don't know the answer. All right. Well, that's our show for this week.
Danger,
thanks again.
Danger's my middle name. Yeah, right. Okay.
Beware the Ides of March.
Yeah, that too.
We will see you, everyone, again. Well, we'll talk at you again in two more weeks. And we've got some interesting things coming down the road. We've already got some topics lined up. Mm-hmm. Some ideas. So stay tuned. We'll have all the details in two more weeks at podcast.nikonians.org.
All right. Bye-bye.